Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
Speaking with Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow this morning, 12 days to go before the U.S. election. What do negotiations on the next stimulus bill really mean for markets? On earnings, we're going to take a look at Tesla. Tesla shares are worth about five times what they were at the start of the year. So what's driving Tesla's growth? And we'll look at Netflix. We saw shares tumble after subscriber additions and guidance missed estimates. Is this just a ding for Tesla, or will it suffer materially moving forward? And Invesco is launching a new NASDAQ ETF to capitalize on the tech craze. What does this mean for you, the investor? First up, it's time to say a very good morning. Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow. I hope you've been indoors most of the day. It's been pouring.
Sadly has, huh? Gloomy outlook out there.
Absolutely. I had to take a boat to work today, basically. Gosh. All right, let's start with Tesla. Elon Musk's electric car maker has posted its fifth straight quarter of profits. Tesla always seemed to be in the red. It's a different story, Arun. Tesla netted more than $330 million in the third quarter, double its profits from a year earlier. What do you think it's doing differently?
So, you know, like it's all about the details of the earnings report, right? So on a headline basis, and, you know, hats off to Elon Musk, coming up with close to, I think, this year, 320,000 deliveries has been phenomenal, right? The world was basically shut for 3 or 4 months, including his big Fremont plant in California. Yet he managed to scrape through, not just scrape through, but come up with phenomenal deliveries. So from that aspect, kudos to him. But one of the big question marks, I would say, is the roughly $400 million of regulatory credits that they earned. Now, all of that money comes from your traditional companies like Ford, GM, et cetera, who have only been producing, gasoline-powered cars. Mm-hmm. They need to try and buy these credits from any other entity that's out there, which hopefully has surplus credits because they're not releasing toxic fumes into the environment. So that was a massive tailwind that Tesla had for this earnings. But overall, though, excluding that, gross margins now at close to like 24%, fantastic. Gone are the days of, Elon Musk sleeping in the office because apparently there was only enough cash for the company to last for like 6 or 7 days more. Mm-hmm. Now they have something like $14.5 billion of cash lying in their accounts, post all the capital raises, post some additional cash flow through operations, profitability, etc. So from the complete downside doomsday scenario, that event should be completely written off. But on the flip side, though, a big question is, how will they get to that massive 500,000 deliveries, which they've promised time and again from the beginning of the year, as recently as Battery Day, a couple of weeks back? How will they get to that number? Because that's still a delivery of 181,000 for Q4. And that's a big question mark, because if you look at Model 3, which is their all-time bestseller, the numbers have started to peter off in the last couple of weeks, especially, and a month odd, in big markets like China, as well as Norway. So there's a lot more competition coming out, be it from local Chinese companies, BYD, et cetera, as well as, you know, like Audi's have come up with a really cool electric car. Volvo has too. So we are seeing a lot more competition in this space. But overall market size is obviously huge. They're now tooting their Model Y, which is like the semi-SUV, I would say. But that's going to be carry them through the growth for the rest of the year, including sales in China. So have they done really well headline number wise this quarter? Absolutely. Mm. Should the share price be valued at this price? I would say no, but would I short it? Definitely not.
Well said, well said. I've been curious about these regulatory credits because, as you so rightly pointed out, Tesla revenue, $6.04 billion, 7% of that coming from the sale of regulatory credits, these zero-emission vehicle and other regulatory credits. And the thing is, there isn't a lot of transparency around the pricing of these credits, how these credits come about. So it's hard for any shareholder to predict how the future sales of these credits, whether they're going to increase or decrease, how this could affect Tesla's bottom line.
Absolutely spot on, right? Like, there's a market for these things. By a market, I mean there's a bid and offer, and the price does vary of these from month to month, week to week, etc. This question was addressed to the CFO of the company, and they're fully cognizant of the fact that, you know, by end 2022, I believe, they will not be able to get any kinds of regulatory credits because pretty much all the traditional car manufacturing companies would have figured out their own electric vehicles or figured out another way to try and not have to pay this regulatory dollar. So from that aspect, Tesla knows that, but it's just important to, you know, for the investors right now who are listening to the show, who are looking at the stock, looking at just the pure headline number of profitability, et cetera, it's not purely because of existing operations. So from an aspect of, is this company able to create a car, sell it at a gross margin? Yes, they've achieved that. Is it able to actually make money at the bottom line, like the net income level? Are they able to do that just by selling cars? It isn't. Yes, this company is valued at like over, you know, $500 million, which should be raising some kind of question marks in people's minds, I would say.
Okay, well said. Let's turn to the big picture. The U.S. election's 12 days away, and Morgan Stanley has an interesting thesis saying that a blue wave, a Democratic sweep, is going to unleash more fiscal stimulus and could bring forward those Fed rate hikes. What do you think?
It's I would kind of agree with that because, you know, the Democratic Party is definitely more in tune with trying to pump in a lot more money into the economy, be it to the working class, and for that matter, spending a lot more on infrastructure and stuff. Like, you know, the last time presumably you or anyone else has traveled to the U.S. would be close to last year. And if you just compare Changi Airport vis-a-vis pretty much any airport you land in the U.S., it's literally going from a first world country to a third world country, right? So there's a lot of money, and the highways are a complete mess over there, the train system for passengers too. So a lot of money has to be deployed. And this is like trillions of dollars, right, given the scale and size of the U.S. economy. So with that amount of stimulus spending, be it to individual welfare paychecks or into the economy, that is one thing that can truly generate a lot of inflation, because even if you can see COVID numbers, they're rising in the U.S., right? So even if companies start backing down, if the government starts spending that kind of money and inflation starts spiking up, sure, the Fed has come out saying, you know, in the short run, it's definitely going to remain zero. Even if inflation goes above 2%, which was their targeted level, even if it does go above that, we're not going to increase interest rates because it's all about the average of inflation over a certain time period. So even if we see inflation creeping up to 2.5% and maybe even 3%, it would have to take place for an extended period of time, be it 6 months, be it a year. So from that perspective, I don't envision the Fed to be suddenly turning things around. Democrats are in power. Oh, let's start increasing interest rates because we're going to try and preempt inflation coming back in. It will be a lot more of a wait and see approach. Let the whole, you know, 2022 go by, and then 2021 definitely go by, and probably in 2022, that's when they'll start making reassessments of this. So, yeah, I kind of agree with the, I think it was JP Morgan you mentioned.
Morgan Stanley.
So Morgan Stanley's report, it makes sense from that perspective. But I don't think from a short-term basis, and that includes anywhere from like 3 months up to a year, that's something that investors need to be, I mean, obviously should be cautious about, But I don't think that's going to start playing a big headwind into the market.
All right. Let's look at the short term then. I think hopes are evaporating fast about stimulus coming through before the November 3rd elections. The Dow on track for its first weekly loss in a month, in large part because the Democrats and Republicans in Congress and the White House can't agree on the size of a new stimulus bill. And without that fuel for the economy, traders are pessimistic. So what does stimulus not coming through before November 3rd really mean for markets?
That's a very scary situation, right? Because, you know, as we were discussing just a couple of minutes earlier, the COVID numbers are increasing. And if you look at what various governments in Europe have done, they have to go back down to clamping down the economy. You know, be it in terms of number of people that are able to show up to work and start spending over there, or keeping restaurants and bars, etc., open. London's in a semi-lockdown. If you look at the cases spiking in France, in Germany, in Spain, in Italy, the numbers are going through the roof. So governments have no choice until a proper vaccine has come out. They have no choice but to close down the economy. And when that happens, you know, jobs will be lost unless the equivalent of like a job support scheme in Europe or the U.S. kicks in. Numbers, if you look at in the U.S., based on 7-day averages, 14-day averages, they're definitely spiking across the board. Is that a function of weather? Is it a function of people taking this thing a bit too casually, too soon? Whatever might be the reason, the bottom line is, if numbers keep going the way that they are, we will start seeing more and more headlines of cities or counties or states going to shut down again. You throw that into the midst of this whole, you know, November elections in the U.S., where both parties are extremely opposed to the other one, and there's massive friction between the Democrats and the Republicans, be it from, you know, even getting a Supreme Court judge on board, all the way to a bigger issue of how are they going to start deploying stimulus and what form, in what amounts. And if that doesn't happen, and the numbers keep spiking up, and unemployment, you know, starts going back on the upward trajectory in terms of percentage unemployed, that's something that can be very scary. And it could lead to a, you know, a definitely like a short-term correction in the markets, because the Fed, God bless its soul for what it did, in, you know, from March middle, give or take. What do they have left in the bag? Sure, they can spend more money and start buying more assets, start going more actively into equities, etc. But at the end of the day, the country, the entire country as a whole, it needs support from the federal government, from state governments, in the form of the stimulus. And it could be quite scary if that does not come through, especially if we have some kind of like a hung election. And this goes into the Supreme Court, and then November and December gets written off. It starts making things very uncertain, and markets, the one thing markets hate is uncertainty, right?
Yeah. I think the last time we talked, you talked about the bookmakers in Las Vegas, but it looks like Biden's lead is increasing, and fears of that hung election or drawn out election are evaporating. What do you think?
They definitely have, right? Which is great. But then if you know, just go back 4 years, the odds of Hillary Clinton beating Trump were extremely high after the first debate also. And then things took a very quick turn over the next month odd 4 years ago. So yes, it's 2 weeks. Yes, there's a, you know, the Democrats have learned their mistake, hopefully. There's a lot of action going on in terms, like, you know, President Obama had come out to speak for Biden in a rally in Pennsylvania. And for that matter, if you look at the wallet size, I believe the Biden camp has something like $200 million, whereas the Trump camp only has like about $50 or $60 million. So there's this big article in New York Times or Wall Street Journal about how, you know, rich investment bankers and financiers mm-hmm. were not looking to support Trump as much as they did 4 years back. And that's something, you know, and obviously money talks, right? Like, when you need that kind of solid amount of money to be able to buy all those social media advertisements, spend money on volunteers to be able to spread the message of your respective party out there. So it seems like all arrows are leading towards Biden being the next president. But you never know with Trump, right? Like, he's this maverick who pulls something out of his hat at the last minute. And that's something which, if it does come close, and it doesn't need to be the national vote, right? Because it's not about if 54% of the U.S. votes for Biden versus right. 46%, et cetera. Mm. Even in a couple of states, especially Florida, right, or Ohio, like some of the more closer battleground states, even if there's some number of votes that could be classified as mail-in ballot, they should be disqualified, et cetera, it could easily lead to a hung parliament or into a hung government.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know it was still so tenuous. Now I understand the calls for putting aside complacency.
To everything in life, sadly, right?
To everything. All right. Let's turn to corporate earnings and Netflix, which bested its revenue goals but fell short on profitability. So the company managed to best analyst revenue expectations of $6.38 billion, but it missed out on analyst per share profit expectations of $2.13. People were expecting its subscriber growth to diminish as the pandemic progressed, and people have more options now versus earlier lockdowns. But what did you make of its earnings? And what do the numbers signal to you about Netflix profits, prospects for the rest of the year?
Sure. So this is just to give it some context, last quarter were absolute blowout earnings, right? In terms of top line, bottom line, as in the quarter before this one. All, as you rightfully mentioned, COVID pandemic, people are locked at home. What are they going to do? Let's download Netflix, the app, and start watching some pretty amazing content. So from that perspective, they came off of such a high pedestal, it was always going to be very difficult to even remotely match that. But this is exactly the problem that's there when you get into momentum stocks, right? Because the expectations are so sky high. This is a company that's, at something like a $200, $215 billion market cap company, trading at an 80 price to earnings ratio. So when you're dealing with such high fundamental valuations, you need to be able to deliver that massive top line and bottom line growth. And sadly, it was just not able to live up to those expectations where I believe, Asia Pacific was going to be their massive growth segment, hoping for 2 million subscribers. I think only 1 million came on board. Yes. So there's definitely that aspect of it not being able to manage its extremely high expectations that are there in the market. But that being said, it did have a really good quarter. I think the bigger issue might be as we go down this, as we, progress towards the end of the year and definitely in 2021, mm-hmm. is going to be the massive competition from Disney. So, their online content is even though they were not in this space, just purely from the fact of the franchise that it has, it's going to be able to wrap all of those things and put it up in online content. Are they going to suffer from amusement parks? Absolutely. Are they going to suffer from movie ticket sales, a drop in movie ticket sales? Absolutely. But now when they come up with their own avenue to be able to get this content directly to the consumer, Netflix style, it's going to take a matter of time, obviously, for them to be able to get the license requirements in Singapore and India and Indonesia, et cetera, the way Netflix has. Mm. But once that's done, just the sheer content bank that they have is something that Netflix should be extremely concerned about. So I think that's going to be something. I think the Netflix Disney saga is just beginning, and we're going to be seeing a lot more headlines of that over the course of this year and definitely next year.
Really interesting point there. Yeah, that's great. Speaking of headlines, the U.S.-China tech war doesn't seem to be abating. Beijing countered restrictions with its own new law to curb sensitive exports. The U.S., meanwhile, has sought to persuade countries around the world, particularly close allies, to block Huawei from next-generation 5G networks. Countries like Australia and Japan have essentially blocked Huawei from their 5G infrastructure. On Tuesday, Sweden became the latest country to exclude Huawei from 5G. But the U.S. looking to Brazil to block Huawei. Is this going to be a blow for Huawei given the size of the market in Brazil?
Honestly, Huawei has been receiving blows from the U.S. for the last year or odd, right? And we've talked extensively about this. it can be clearly seen, you know, why this is happening. The U.S. is going to pull out all its measures to try and fight, while it can do, while the U.S. itself is a massive economy, it wants to really corner Chinese tech influence, the Chinese government influence, potentially via their tech companies. So Sweden, as you mentioned, Brazil, the UK in the past, the EU, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, you name it, right? Like all of these countries have kind of heeded to the US message of, oh, your data might not be secure. The Chinese government can be influencing you. But I think that that's on the one perspective, right? And then on the other hand, you have China now being able to flex its muscles a lot more and trying to ensure that it can protect its own tech, you know, like the ARM-NVIDIA deal. They're coming up with all sorts of clauses and restrictions to ensure that that might not go through, definitely not in the current form. So you can see why the U.S. is doing it. You can see why China is doing it. The difference, though, I feel is that China can play the longer game, right, where it has a massive domestic market. It's been able to create these huge tech conglomerates. Now, if they play their cards rightly, I feel, in the long run, if they slowly start opening up their economy and they enable, you know, Sweden, it's funny because Ericsson, a Swedish homegrown company, generates 10% of its revenues from China. All the major Chinese telcos have some amount of Ericsson hardware equipment installed in their base. So now China's come out saying, look, Sweden, we had kind of opened our borders to you. If you're going to do this to us, we're going to block our borders to you, right? And that, if that tit for tat starts taking place, then all these smaller economies, not the US, but definitely countries like Sweden, Korea, Taiwan, the UK, maybe even EU to some extent, if China plays its cards right and starts opening up its economy some more, I do feel that purely because of you know, the capitalistic world that we live in and the governments have to support its own corporation, they might look the other way. The China, having advantage of the long term, the long game, what it has done really well is managed to ensure that its tech companies have gotten completely ingrained into the Chinese ecosystem.
Right.
As a really good example for that is, let's say Visa, MasterCard, Amex can be fully and openly distributed, like Visa, MasterCard, Amex cards can be freely distributed in China. You know, will it really make a difference? Because everything is now set up with Tencent and Alibaba. It's not going to be that big a detriment now to China, but they can openly proclaim, oh, we've opened up our borders. Now, let's look at another industry, like investment banking. This is something that China just could not execute. Nothing compared to the likes of Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan, even homegrown ones like DBS, etc. So it was like, okay, you know what? My borders are open. You can come on board. You don't need a 49% stake. You can get 100% local subsidiary. So it's playing the smart game that way, of slowly opening up its economy to sectors that it has not been able to create that homegrown talent. The one big question mark, though, is going to be the semiconductor industry, high-precision chips. And that is something that's, you know, the ace in the hole for countries like the US, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, where they need to try and maximize their advantage in that specific sector and try and force China to try and do some things to their benefit. So I think that's going to be the big story that's going to continue. You know, we've talked about it a couple of times, but that's definitely going to be the next 3 to 5 year China plan on how they can try and create a true homegrown high-tech semiconductor capability.
All right. Before we let you go, we always love hearing what investors, you know, really make of certain products out there on the market. SEC Chair Jay Clayton has said that regular investors, mums and the pops, should stay away from high leveraged and embedded option contracts. And that save, if you're saving for retirement or you're saving for your child's school in the future, you shouldn't trust these types of investments. Do you agree?
1,000,000,000%. I mean, leverage is a double-edged sword, right? Like you always hear these cases of friends or some random YouTube ad or something else that pops up on your internet browser about how $2 million have been made options trading in 30 days, etc. It's completely ludicrous, right? Because having been an options trader in a bank for 10 years, I have literally seen every single options desk in pretty much all the banks that I know of. They've blown up at a certain point of time. And this is a trading book that sits in a bank making markets with access to all the information or a much larger amount of information that any retail investor can ever even dream about. So from the perspective of investing and, you know, trying to, especially for retirement, it's of paramount importance to not just get, you know, sucked in by those headlines of 5,000% returns. Mm. All of those people would have gone bankrupt or they will be going bankrupt at some point of time. It's better to just, you know, pay attention to what you know, stay within your circle of competence, slowly start scaling into markets and products that you're completely familiar and comfortable with while having set aside a certain amount of cash for that rainy day, like today, potentially.
Oh, perfect segue. Oh, my goodness. You tied it up so perfectly. Oh, Arun, that was pure literature. Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow. Tremendous insight. Thank you, Arun, for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.